Coming up in this episode.
Imagine it, Peter. You are paddling down the river. You see a boy on the rock. You're kind of, oh, is he in trouble? And so you go up and you try to ask, and the boy's not talking.
The river is a character in the book. It's a force in the book. It makes things happen in the book. It's a condition.
I'm getting some class consciousness vibes from these stories. I mean, the kid's stealing car parts, another kid, you know, basically with a pet fish and a grocery cart in the river. This podcast from Georgia Public Broadcasting highlights books with Georgia connections, hosted by two of your favorite public radio book nerds who also happen to be your hosts of All Things Considered on GPB Radio. I'm Peter Biello.
And I'm Orlando Montoya. Thanks for joining us as we introduce you to authors, their writings, and the insights behind their stories, mixed with our own thoughts and ideas on just what gives these works the narrative edge. Okay, Peter, so on this podcast, we talk about books with Georgia connections.
Right.
So Georgia authors or Georgia subjects.
That's our bread and butter, or bread and biscuit, you might say.
Well, I don't think that I've read a book for this podcast, and we've been doing it for some time. I don't think I've read a book for this podcast that has quite as much sense of place, quite as much Georgia as the book we're going to talk about today. It's called Seven Islands of the Okmulgee by Gordon Johnson.
The Okmulgee, so the river.
What do you know about the mighty Okmulgee?
Absolutely nothing. So educate me, please.
Well, you should know.
What should I know?
It starts here in South Metro Atlanta. We're in Midtown, but it starts in South Metro Atlanta, and it goes to sort of Hazelhurst in the middle of sort of South Georgia, and then it becomes the Altamaha. It goes to the sea.
Is it useful for anything? Like, is it navigable or is it just there?
It's pretty. And okay. So that's what we learn in this book. The book is called Seven Islands of the Okmulgee by Gordon Johnson. And this is seven stories that are kind of set in or around the Okmulgee River. We're talking like, so there's lots of trees, there's lots of water, there's lots of air, there's lots of history. And so there's sort of seven stories here by this author.
Okay. And this author, Gordon Johnson, he's from Macon?
Yeah, he lives in Macon. He's a Mercer University English professor. And he's written a couple of books before. And the one that I think probably informs this book the most is a guide that he wrote to Okmulgee Mounds National Historical Park.
Like a nonfiction travel guide.
Yeah, it's a guide. Like, here's what you're looking at. And I think he focused specifically on the history, sort of going back into the Native American history, the Spanish history, because, you know, the Spanish came through here, and then the early pioneer settler history. And so he draws on this to get sort of the knowledge that he needs for writing these short stories. But, you know, you can have knowledge about a topic, but not the inspiration. Mm-hmm. And so he was inspired to write the stories in this book by paddling down the length of the river.
The second time I paddled the river, when I was moving through these areas I'd seen before, that's when the stories really started to come to me, except for that first story in the book and the beginning of the last story. All the other ones sort of came to me as I was passing through particular areas of the river. Most vividly, when I was going through the Seven Islands section, Smith Shoals, there is one serious drop on the upper Okmulgee River down below Barnett Shoals Dam, a place where you have to be fairly careful. I came around a bend and down a drop there on the river, and there was a kid standing on a rock out in midstream in a really dangerous place to be, and it alarmed me. It turned out his father was right there with him, so he was not at risk. It's not exactly the situation that you see in that story, Seven Islands, but that image really stuck with me, and the story sort of unfolded around it.
So Gordon Johnson, the author, paddled the entire length of the Okmulgee. Twice, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's where he gets the inspirations for these stories.
Is that a thing people do here in Georgia? They paddle the entire length of any given river?
Some are really hard.
Yeah. Well, I bet.
Especially up in like the mountain sections where it's very hard to paddle or canoe in the rocky areas. But, you know, the Okmulgee is this broad sort of thing and you can paddle down it. You've seen it, I hope.
I may have seen it as I've driven by it. I'm
will be the first to admit I'm not the most outdoorsy person. Not that I don't enjoy a good yarn about it.
But it's a South Georgia river, so it's okay. Nice and big and muddy. But in that clip, he's talking about sort of his inspiration for one story in particular.
But there are seven stories in this book.
Yeah, there are seven stories, so I'm not going to talk about all of them.
Yeah. Okay.
But I want to talk about a few, and this one happens to be the title story of the book, called Seven Islands. And it's about basically a woman named Ray who is paddling down the river, and she sees a boy sort of stranded on a rock. And she suspects that the boy is in danger somehow, so she approaches the boy, but the boy's not talking. So the boy's not talking at all, not responding to any questions. He is mute, I guess.
How does she know he's stranded and not sort of...
That's the thing.
Swimming out. So he may not be stranded. He may be like getting ready to go back to where he came from, swim
We
back
don't know. Oh, okay. Imagine it. Imagine it, Peter. You are paddling down the river. You see a boy on the rock. You're kind of, oh, is he in trouble? And so you go up and you try to ask, and the boy's not talking. Meanwhile, there's a storm approaching. You got to make a decision. What are you going to do? Take this boy or not?
Yeah. Okay.
What are you going to do?
Well, you got to investigate, right? I mean, it reminds me of, I had a writing professor who, there were two things he used to say, and this situation I think covers both of them, which is, you know, if you're writing a story and your character encounters a problem, you don't try the most complicated solution to that problem first. You try the simplest solution, right? So it seems like this woman went to talk to him. Yeah. So that's the simplest thing. And then the next thing, if it's a pressing problem, you have to escalate and try the next thing. Like if you're, for example, the example they gave me in workshops back in the day was, if you get home and you find you're locked out of your house, you don't immediately scale the house to the second floor window that you know is open. You know, you try the back door and see if it's unlocked. So that's what seems like she tried to do. But the other thing is that seems like this author is putting a ticking clock here, right? The storm is coming. So you got to do something.
So Ray, the woman, has to make a decision. Is she going to take this boy or not? Okay. And there's no cell phones in this story.
When does it take place?
I don't know. I mean, it's hard to tell when a lot of these stories in the book take place because I don't detect any technology. And that's sort of one thing that I like about the book because it's hard to tell, you know, when the stories took place. And I think one of them was in pioneer times. But yeah, my answer would be call someone.
Yeah, but no cell phones.
There's
no
cell phones. And I asked the author actually about that. Why wasn't there a cell phone in this story? Why is there no... I think in one story, someone uses a walkie-talkie. But I asked him about this, why there was no technology in that story or in many of the other ones.
Partly that development in the book comes from the fact that when I'm on the river, one of the great pleasures of it is I'm completely disconnected. I don't have to keep up with my email and you know, text messages and that sort of thing. I think some of the pleasure that I take in returning to a much more natural flow of time, a much more patient and methodical, there's a kind of deliberation about time on the river that's really nice. And probably that was in the background as I was writing. Many of the stories I felt were coming from a previous time on the river, not out of a contemporary moment. One thing about the Ogmulgee that draws me as much as ever is the sense of a really long human history that's existed and persisted and thrived along that ancient flow. You know, it's a very old river, and as it flows through Macon, it's flowing through a place that's been continuously occupied by people for 12,000 years.
So that's one thing that I like about this book, is it adds to the sense of place that there's not much technology. Getting back to where we were,
yes,
about the boy on the river, Ray, the woman, decides to take the boy down the river and...
Like, wait, forcibly, like,
no,
get in the boat,
no,
or get in the kayak.
It's sort of like, here, we're going to go and try to find out. Yeah, I don't think there was any force, but the boy definitely, they go down the river, and we eventually learn his name, Sam. We find out that he's accused of stealing car parts. We find out that he's got an abusive meth head, no good father. So Ray is trying to protect Sam from law enforcement, because law enforcement's going to hand him back to the father.
Mm.
And she's also trying to protect him from the father. So I won't tell you how the story ends, but we definitely wonder, did Ray do the right thing?
Mm. So is there anything other than sense of place, the wilderness, that ties these stories together, or is it something else?
Yeah, I think it's what I just mentioned, mystery, right?
Mystery.
A lot of these stories end with, like, we don't know what happened. Like what just happened there?
Right? Oh, so the storytelling.
Yeah, the stories leave you with more questions.
Mm.
Like, what happened there? I kind of compared it to Flannery O'Connor. You know, don't you read a lot of Flannery O'Connor and you ask yourself, what happened there?
Mm.
And a lot of that has to do with the dialogue and the backstory. So we don't, you know, we don't hear a lot from these characters. You know, they're not, the dialogue is very limited. They seem to talk in a shorthand. They're kind of like telepathic in a way.
Huh.
Like, hey, what are you doing? Yeah, I heard your mama passed, or something like that. So the dialogue is very limited. So we're left with what happened in the story. There's a sense of mystery about these stories. That's, I like it.
Mm-hmm. I feel like Flannery O'Connor has a pretty firm moral backbone to each of her stories, and there is a moral question at the center of the story that you were just describing. You know, did this woman do the right thing? Is intervening the right thing? Does she know enough? You know, those are the questions that came up in my mind. And you're saying that there's no real resolution. In other words, we don't see whether or not it was a good idea. We just get to an ending point in the story, kind of.
Yeah, stops. I'm not going to tell you the ending, but I think we are left with the question: what happens next? And did Ray do the right thing? And what's going to happen to the boy? Again, so we get invested in this boy, we get invested in Ray, and then it ends. So you asked, you know, what are some other themes in this book? So I would say mystery is definitely a theme. And that also comes up in the first story in the book. And the first story is called The Only Place to Start From. And I asked Johnson how he came up with that story.
The first story in the book that I completed was The Only Place to Start From, the first story in the collection. That one started around 2005. And I wrote that off seeing a grocery cart in the river. And as I had been paddling, I saw a grocery cart there in the river. And I had also been reading about the Mississippian history along the river, how they trapped gar and used different parts of the garfish, you know, to make tattoos, for ceremonial purposes, that kind of thing. So those two things sort of came together, and that was the first of the stories that I completed.
So let me set the scene for you on this story. The main character is a grocery store manager. He manages a Publix. His name is Peavy, and he's lost his grocery cart. And his grocery cart is down there. He's got lots of grocery carts, but he wants this one back because it's down there. I mean, how many times have you crossed over a river here and you see a grocery cart down there?
Oh, it's certainly a thing. Yeah.
Well, Peavy wants his back. So Peavy says, there's my grocery cart down there. I'm going to go get it. So he goes down. He's in the river. He falls down. He gets mud all over him. He's covered in water. And then a boy appears on the bridge above, and the boy says, that's my fish. And I didn't tell you, the cart has like a fish stuck in it. There's like a fish swimming around in the grocery cart. So the boy up there says, that's my fish. And so the boy comes down, offers to help Peavy get his cart out of the river. In the meantime, the boy stabs the fish and holds it up. And so they get to talking. But again, it's the sort of mysterious conversation that's very terse. And so we get this relationship between Peavy and the boy. We get this conversation going on. And so Peavy decides that he wants to learn more about this boy. The boy goes away. They go down. He finds out that the boy is perhaps homeless, living in a camp down by the river. And the boy is talking in riddles. He claims some sort of Native American spirituality. He starts talking about like the helper. He starts talking about like the original fire. He starts talking about the seven directions. And so the questions in my mind are, you know, does this kid have mental health issues? The Rangers think he's a thief.
Another thief boy.
Another thief, mysterious boy.
Okay.
So, and again, I won't tell you how it ends, but I think that, you know, through the course of the story, we learn as much as we can. And then we say, what the heck just happened there? You know, so I kind of like that. It sort of leaves you with questions.
Well, I'm getting some class consciousness vibes from these stories. I mean, that the kid stealing car parts, another kid, you know, basically with a pet fish and a grocery cart in the river.
Definitely. So I think all of the stories in this book, are sort of hard scrabble working class people. There are no college professors in this book, except the one who wrote it. And there's not a lot of sort of deep conversation. No one idles in small talk. And I said, the dialogue is very direct. And I can't decide, again, if that's a product of the class situation, if it's a product of necessity. You know, these are short stories, so let's get quick dialogue. Or if it's a product of his writing style, the author's writing style. And so I asked the author that. I said, why is the dialogue in this book so sort of terse and mysterious?
You know, on the river, the exchanges you have on the river are often, they're not what you'd call loquacious. You know, you're paddling, you're on the current. Here's a guy anchored in his boat, and he's casting for bass up to the bank, right? And you might say, you getting any? You know, and his answer is, few. You know, and maybe there are a couple of other words scattered in there, but conversation, and it's not that people are terse either. It's more a sense of relaxation, you know, behind that shortness. Some of it might be that. And some of these characters too are sort of tough. They're kind of tough. They're a little hard bitten.
So can't you understand there how maybe some of these stories would be like mysteries if you get this kind of very, working class kind of talk?
It seems like the dialogue's making you work for it, which I think is great in a way. I mean, you're there. You're bringing your imagination to it. So what do they mean by saying you getting any? I mean, that's certainly you get the kind of sense of who is saying that, the kind of person who's saying that. It's interesting.
Yeah. And yeah.
Well, what would you say? Are there any other examples of hard-bitten characters here?
Yeah. So some of the other stories that I liked, one was called Skin Trade, and that was about a female model and escort, and it actually takes place in Chicago, but it's got some Macon and Okmulgee appearances in it. Another story was called Burying Ground, and now that was a A-class Flannery O'Connor type story there, because it involved a preacher.
Okay.
And the preacher is trying to baptize a sinner before he dies. And so they go down to the river. But, you know, you want to know what the main character is?
Tell me.
In all of these stories, why don't you guess?
Georgia.
The river. Right?
The river.
The river. The river itself is the main character in these stories. And in these stories, the river has a flow. It has a will of its own. It has a force.
Is it dangerous?
It is very dangerous. It is very dangerous. It can kill you. It electrified one guy. It did. So it electrified a guy. I think, was there another man who died in the book? So yeah, it does have a force. It's ancient, it's transformative, and it's healing. I think, and again, sorry not to mention Flannery O'Connor again, but you know kind of how Flannery in her short stories, kind of like there's a strike, there's like a lightning strike, and something changes mm-hmm. in these stories. And I think that happens also in these stories as well. The river transforms these characters.
The river is a character in the book. It's a force in the book. It makes things happen in the book. It's a condition. And all of these characters, to some extent, are sort of pushing back against the river in some way. I don't know how I would care. I don't know what word I would use to describe the Ogmulgee's character. I will say that all rivers, this is one of the things I love about paddling, whether it's a kayak or a canoe. When you get on the river, you can't stop. You know, you are subjecting yourself, you're subjugating yourself to this greater will.
Now, when I was in school, way back, a long time ago, my English professor taught me there was only three type of stories in the world: man versus man versus self, and man versus nature. Mm-hmm. And so this would definitely be man versus nature type stories.
So what gives this book the narrative edge?
Well, I think, again, what I said about before, a sense of mystery in the stories, spirituality, obviously, because there's a lot of sort of Native American thoughts coming in. It's impossible also, one thing I'll say, it's impossible to make judgments about the characters in these stories because, as I said, there's not a lot of information you have to go on. You're sort of going on feel, you're going on looks, you're going on size, you're kind of size, S-I-G-H-S, not S-I-Z-E. So you're sort of going on just how they're acting, and you think to yourself, why is that person doing that, right? And how many times do you go through life and you see somebody doing something weird? There's a lot of weird in these stories. A lot of weird in these stories. How many times do you see somebody doing something weird and you go, why is that person doing that? Well, you don't know anything about this person.
Yeah.
So you don't know that person's story. So I would highly recommend this book. And not only me, it was a Townsend Prize finalist. Townsend Prize being...
It's an award here in Georgia for books published here.
So work...
or written by someone here.
Narrative fiction. And that's where I got him to sign my book. Thank you, Gordon, for signing my book. So it's a great book, and that's why I recommend it.
All right. Well, the book is Seven Islands of the Ogmulgee River Stories by Gordon Johnson. Orlando, thank you so much for telling me about it.
Pleased to tell you about it.
And should mention to people listening on NPR One or whatever podcast app of choice that we're also doing this on video now.
Yeah, that's what you look like.
I've never seen you before. We used to be in different studios, in different buildings, in different cities. No, that's not true. But yeah, you get to look at us now. Lucky you.
Yeah, well, welcome to the video podcast. Welcome to the podcast. And we'll see you all next time. Thanks for listening to Narrative Edge. We'll be back in 2 weeks with a brand new episode. This podcast is a production of Georgia Public Broadcasting. Find us online at gpb.org/narrativeedge.
You can also catch us on the daily GPB News podcast, Georgia Today, for a concise update on the latest news in Georgia. For more on that and all of our podcasts, go to gpb.org/podcasts.
When a massive chemical fire erupted at the biolab facility in Conyers, thick smoke filled the air, forcing evacuations. But for many, it wasn't the first time, and it wouldn't be the last. I'm Pamela Kirkland. In GPB's new podcast, Manufacturing Danger, The Biolab Story, I investigate what caused the fire, the response, and what it means for Conyers residents today. Listen at gpb.org/podcast or wherever you get your podcasts.